Good morning, gentlemen. It's a pleasure to be here with you this morning. And certainly it's an honor to be the inaugural speaker for this leadership forum in New Hampshire. I also want to thank Bill and Rick for pursuing this idea and setting up the first meeting. I hope I can get the forum off to a good start. I also know that each of you has made a real sacrifice to be here, and I think you're to be congratulated for caring enough to reflect with me on these important themes of professional work, family, and faith. I think no matter what I share, just the fact that you're taking the time for reflection will be very beneficial to you. Now, our talk for today is Keeping Priorities Straight, Integrating Faith, Family, and Work. And to explore this theme, I'll share some personal experiences in my own life, which I hope you'll allow me. I think it will show better than pure abstractions or tidy theories how we each struggle to live our core values, how we struggle to keep priorities in our life. I'm also going to offer specific ideas for your consideration, drawn from those experiences as we go along. And at the end, a few more general comments. Okay? So let's launch right in with the first idea, which may seem uninspired, but it's actually a very important motif throughout my remarks. And you've heard it many times. Idea number one, ideas have consequences. Or better, ideas should have consequences. And let me adjust that into more of a challenge for us here today. Let each of us have the courage and integrity to allow our key ideas to have consequences in our life. In other words, let us strive to identify our key, rather core values, and then work to align our lifestyle and daily behavior with those ideas. If we do that, we are keeping priorities straight. Now, what I contend to do, and you're probably similar, is I often allow immediate circumstances and superficial pressures to direct my life and actions. I let the urgent override the important. I spend most of my time putting out fires and almost no time reflecting on what started them in the first place. Is that right? Does that sound familiar? And that's why meetings like this can be very helpful. We're trying to step back a bit, to meet other professionals facing similar issues, discuss important topics, and to formulate priorities for those three key areas of faith, family, and work. Now, allow me to start with faith. And I'm going to go back quite a ways in my own life. I was brought up in a home without any religion or faith whatsoever. My family lived outside Philadelphia. It was a suburb called the Main Line, and it was very affluent, though my own family was quite middle class. Now, interestingly, one idea seemed very clear to me as a young, unformed teen growing up, and that was that the rampant materialism that I saw around me was not enough to make life meaningful. I knew there must be more. Now, unfortunately, Christianity struck me as hypocritical and not to be taken seriously, because it preached about service to the poor, love for the poor, but all I saw were supposed Christians pursuing material wealth with all their heart, mind, and soul. Looking elsewhere, I came upon transcendental meditation. You heard of it? Well, basically, it's a simple form of Eastern meditation where you sit quietly, repeat a mantra, and supposedly this can eventually lead you to a state of enlightenment or nirvana. Now, for me, this seemed a legitimate antidote to the consuming materialism that I saw around me and also to the escapism of the drug culture that was popular at the time. Instead of spending holidays at the beach or hanging out with friends, I would go on retreats, times of complete silence and extra meditation. In fact, when junior year of high school came around and it was time to look at colleges, I didn't even contemplate attending any college except Maharishi International University, located in Fairfield, Iowa. I was so enthused about going there that I skipped my senior year to get there as soon as possible. Now, the reason I'm sharing this with you from my very distant past is because I was taking an idea about faith, in my case, the idea of spiritual enlightenment, and making it a priority in my life. I was letting an important idea have consequences. And Maharishi International University seemed ideal. Oh, wait a minute. Poor Bill, he's looking very worried. He's checking his papers. He's looking for the name of the speaker. Do we have the right speaker here? Paul Swope, two Ivy League schools. What's going on? No worries, Bill. The bio was accurate. You can relax. But maybe not picture, perfectly complete. I'm just fleshing things out a bit. I didn't include in the bio, for example, that one of the techniques I learned at MIU was levitation. We actually practiced it together as a university, transforming the gymnasium into a flying center where we covered the entire floor with thick foam and we could practice our hopping and flying techniques. And, well, that's a topic for another day. Sorry. But speaking of Ivy League schools, I'm allowed to make a joke at their expense, aren't I? Okay? How many spoiled, arrogant Ivy League kids does it take to screw in a light bulb? Anybody know? Well, it's just one. He holds up the light bulb and the universe revolves around him. So I spent three idealistic, wholesome, and actually academically intense years at the Maharishi School. And I have to admit, I moved on and chose not to come back the last year, not because of a spiritual call, but because I was getting restless. I'd done very well academically at MIU, and I wanted to see if I could succeed in the real academic world and do well at a respected institution. And also, frankly, I was weary of living such an austere, chaste lifestyle. So I took summer courses at the University of Pennsylvania. I fell for a lovely girl from Brown who was taking summer courses there as well, and decided not to return to the idealistic bubble of MIU. One could say my priorities shifted from the spiritual to the more carnal. And I was making that a priority, a key to finding happiness. Any votes? No, it was not. And after I graduated from Penn, I was still searching. I decided to hitchhike around the world and see what new insight I could gather in foreign countries. I'll skip over that time, except to say that after about a year and a half and going through roughly 20 countries, I came upon a community in Switzerland called L'Abri, which means the shelter in French. And L'Abri was a Christian community founded to basically present the case for Christianity to people like me, disbelievers and unbelievers. It's a wonderful place. And I didn't actually embrace Christianity while I was there, but my life was completely changed, and again, by a very important idea. It was there that I confronted the issue of abortion. Up to that point, I had simply assumed that abortion was a necessary and even compassionate response to the problem of an unwanted pregnancy. But when I read that after an abortion, the pieces of the child's body have to be reassembled to be sure everything has been evacuated so the woman does not get an infection, it became immediately clear to me that abortion was a horrible act of violence that could not be justified. So remember my opening theme for consideration. Core values should have consequences. Align your lifestyle with your core values. Well, there I was, staying in a tent outside the L'Abri community with a young lady. I'll make this short and to the point. What if that young lady became pregnant? Would I make a mockery of marriage and marry someone with whom I had little in common? Would I be the ultimate coward and abandon her to raise the child alone? Or would I support killing my own innocent child? Now there are a set of ideas that have consequences. As I reflected on this issue, my faith in modern secular society began to unravel. If it could be so wrong in calling something as abominable as abortion liberating, then maybe it was just as wrong in its total disdain for Christianity. And secular society had promoted this idea of sex without consequences. And it was this idea that I now saw as nothing but a dangerous and deceptive illusion. Gentlemen, I believe that this illusion of sex without consequences is numbing the consciences and castrating the spiritual sensitivities of countless young men and women. This is one of the reasons that the pro-life message is so powerful and so important. So idea number two, stand up for life and encourage your kids to think about this core value and act upon it. So this talk is on keeping priorities straight. At that time, I had to honor my pro-life convictions and live a chaste lifestyle. I also knew it was time to take a closer look at Christianity. I decided to return to America and volunteer at a pro-life office. And shortly thereafter, I was blessed with the grace of a very intense conversion experience. And a deep faith has remained with me to this day. Thanks be to God. I did, in fact, return briefly to Europe, this time for a pro-life conference, and was blessed to meet Jenny, the woman who is to become my wife, who was also attending from the States. At that time, I was accepted into the Graduate School of Education at Harvard, and I completed that degree just before Jenny and I were married. Upon graduation, there were job offers, but my passion and my priority, my core value, remained the pro-life cause. So I accepted a very low-paying administrative job at the local office in Boston, the pro-life office. And here we come upon idea number three. Don't be afraid to put convictions above comfort, ideals over income. Now, I'm sure every one of you in this room has a tale of an unpredictable turn in your professional life. Life rarely goes in a straight line, right? Well, one of mine happened early on. I was living on a small salary, about $16,000 a year, but of course I wanted a stable home for my family. So I accepted an offer from a married couple. They were actually very good friends from the Maharishi school days, and they had moved to Boston as well, to joint own a two-family home in Waltham, Massachusetts. They both had good income, good jobs, but I had enough for a down payment from a modest inheritance from my grandfather. Seemed like a perfect match. However, not long before my wife Jenny was to give birth to our first child, this other couple announced that they were moving. Well, Jenny was in no condition to move and create a new nest, and I certainly didn't make enough money to get a place on our own. So what to do? I rented out the other side of the house, and voila, became a landlord. Now, my first tenants were quiet and paid rent on time, so I concluded that being a landlord was easy. Wow, was I a naive kid back then. And back in the 1980s, real estate was booming and banks were almost begging people for loans. So I worked out with our friend to buy out his half of the house, and a year later, we bought a second two-family directly across the street, moving in so that we could keep the interest low and qualify for the loan, and then fixing it up and renting it out. My side career in real estate was underway. What I want to emphasize, however, is it did not start as a financial decision, but as a family one, putting the needs of the family first and keeping my low-paying but rewarding job. It was an attempt to keep my priorities straight. The name of the C-Corp that I was to form many years later, well, several years later, is Plus Five Management. Because at that time, I had five kids, I planned more, and I planned for this company to be the main asset that would help them through private school, college, etc. In fact, I resolved, the good Lord willing, to buy one property for every dependent in my family and to stop there. I kept that resolution, and I now own 10 income properties. So if you're following the math, that's the 9 kids plus the 1 wife. Back at the pro-life office, I had been named the executive director for the state right-to-life office, though still on a modest salary. And like many young men hoping to save the world, I probably worked too hard and too long. I saw a need to realign my priorities. In order to be home more, I made the decision to move to New Hampshire and to restrict my hours working at the main office, come what may, even if it meant losing my job. Fortunately, other Right to Life organizations had seen the rapid growth in the Massachusetts group, and they'd been asking me for help, as fundraising seemed to be my specialty. Now, what nonprofit doesn't need fundraising, right? So I ended up forming my own company and being a consultant to a number of pro-life groups and nonprofits around the country. This allowed me to work out of the home every day and involve the kids. This, in fact, is idea number four. Whenever possible, involve your kids in your work. At least expose them to it. You know, otherwise, Dad is some mysterious being who disappears nearly the whole day, almost every day, and that disappearing act is somehow mysteriously related to keeping a home and having food on the table. Let them in on the secret as best you can. When I started my consulting business, I remember hiring my kids and their friends to, for example, open fundraising letters. As I was organizing very large direct mail campaigns, so there were thousands of envelopes to be opened. And I marketed those long hours as pizza parties. Slave labor? Absolutely. And I remain unrepentant to this day. So idea number five, work is good for kids, their minds and their bodies. Kids can work better and longer and at younger ages than you think. In today's culture, we spoil kids to the detriment of their character. That consulting business continued to expand, and I was offered national fundraising positions with good salaries and benefits, and I turned them down, not wanting to disrupt the family. I even decided to phase out the consulting, as it too was growing and demanding a great deal of time. I chose to focus on one pro-life group, and even for a time worked for 100% commission. Now, that job took me around the world on various speaking tours. And in this case, too, I made the financial sacrifice to bring children with me. I took one daughter to Dublin, another to Rome, a group of three teens, I remember, I took to Austria. And at one point, we took the entire family, or actually eight of the nine children, with my wife to Kenya. Now, those were very busy years, and I found going to the gym to be indispensable in releasing stress and just clearing the mind. I should have made it a numbered idea of its own, perhaps. Men, go to the gym. It's just so helpful. I might even say essential. As my interest in fitness grew, I became very interested in the parallels between developing physical fitness and developing spiritual fitness. Sounds strange, I know. But for example, we make the same excuses for both, or not doing them. Now see if nearly all the excuses I'm going to read to you don't sound really familiar. So imagine you've just joined a gym and are, I don't know, starting to lift weights, or you've started to take the time to sit down and pray in silence. Ready? I am not cut out for this. This doesn't feel right. I don't have time for this. I'm getting nowhere. Nothing is changing. Why bother? This is a great idea some other time, but today I'm just too tired. Or such and such is much more important right now. And so on. Yes? Haven't we all made these excuses to ourselves? Or am I the only lazy bum in the room? Well, there are also more positive parallels. Now, in both cases, any lasting progress requires two things. First, a long-range vision, clearly in mind. And second, concrete daily actions that are in line with that long-range goal. You know, neither is an activity you can just sprinkle onto your life and expect magic, right? Both require commitment to a lifestyle over time. Both require a proper set of priorities. So, in addition to my regular jobs with the real estate and pro-life work, I became a certified personal trainer and was hired as a fitness trainer at a gym. Then I launched a website presenting the interesting parallels between faith and fitness. Now, my hope was to encourage people solely focused on their physical health to see that spiritual muscles need exercise too. After all, most of us are not born with spiritual muscles any more than we're born with bulging pecs or washboard abs. It takes time. It takes patience. It takes work. It takes coaching. Now, for another twist in the road, I did make one career decision based solely on money, on financial gain. It was about this time the value of the real estate I had grew considerably, and I thought I could just about retire if I sold all my real estate, kept the family on a very tight budget, and made all the right returns on my new investments. Well, I made a bad decision, or I was given bad advice, and a company went bankrupt just weeks after I had made a six-digit investment in it. Guess the good Lord did not want me to retire early. And looking back, I think I was an idiot to have been considering retiring at that time. I was probably in my early 40s. But it turns out it was fortunate that I had followed my passion and become a trainer at the local gym, because I was the personal trainer of a man who was involved in retail, and he was looking to expand his business. I liked the imported products he sold, and he was willing to advance the merchandise required without any payment up front. So I opened two stores that very first year with no training whatsoever. I had never even touched a cash register in my life. I remember when I had my first sale, I panicked a bit and I thought, oh my God, what do I do now? What button do I push? But we survived. And it turned out to be a good choice, as I was able to make back the money I had lost, and eventually I established my own retail company and opened about 35 temporary seasonal stores across 7 states. Now here again, I involved the family, and every single one of my 9 children and my wife has been involved in opening, running, or closing at least some of those stores. In fact, right now, my 16-year-old daughter is paying her own way through Catholic high school and private violin lessons by helping at the store. I pay her very generously, but within legal standards, and she pays all her own tuition, music lessons, and personal expenses out of her own bank account. And Dad gets a 100% write-off for his business. It works the same with travel, as I can write off most of the expenses when I go to different countries with the kids or my wife, and we buy merchandise for an upcoming store. Now, this is a key financial advantage to having your own small business. It may be the greatest legal loophole in the entire tax code. You're allowed to write off any legitimate expense before you're taxed, whereas as an employee, you are taxed before you can spend anything. The difference between the two is enormous. While somewhat out of step with this talk, I'll make this idea number 6. If possible, incorporate your own business to promote something you are passionate about and enjoy, among other things, huge tax benefits. Now, I'll wind down my own story with probably my craziest idea. Another passion of mine is music. And in our house, the children have to take 2 years of an instrument, at which time they could elect to stop playing, change instruments, whatever they like. And since I played piano at the time, and we had 2 pianos in the house, I ended up teaching piano and basic music theory to just about all my kids, one-on-one. I found it to be an intimate, intense, and fun form of communication. And you all know how hard it is to communicate with your teens at all, not to mention make it intimate and intense and fun. So I felt I had found a gold mine of an opportunity to deepen my relationship with each child, and I wanted to see it grow. I also felt strongly about the importance of being exposed to other cultures, particularly through the discipline of learning a foreign language. But modern American life doesn't leave much room for these things, does it? If we think about it, the kids have to get up early. They have a very long day at school, followed by sports, followed by homework. And I had long days of work. How much gas is left in the tank? I was looking for some way to better align my priorities with our daily lifestyle, And one day I had a kind of epiphany. It was actually after a piano lesson with one of my sons. If we homeschooled our children, instead of putting them in expensive private schools, we would save the vast bulk of our annual expenses and still be able to give them the religious and moral training we thought was essential. And if I rented my own large home we lived in, it would bring in substantial income. So, homeschool the kids, take them to Europe to live and to learn another language, we chose Italian, focus there on musical development, rent my home to help fund the trip, and have my assistant continue to manage the other real estate. My retail stores were seasonal, so we could just skip a year or two. No problem. Well, needless to say, the whole family had to buy into this rather wild idea, but we did, in fact, rent our house and move to Europe for about 2 years. It was a terrific experience. And this whole venture is an example of idea number 7. Be willing to take risks and to be creative in finding ways to keep your core values at the forefront. Now allow me to end by revisiting in a more general way each of those main themes that dominates our lives, work, family, and faith. To keep priorities straight, I find it very helpful to regularly contemplate the reason why I am here in the first place. If I have my ultimate end and purpose in front of me, then I can better evaluate the daily steps I'm taking that lead me there, or as the case may be, that lead me in an opposite direction from my true end. So let's look at faith, work, and family from two lenses, we'll call them. The first lens is our original destiny, our nature and purpose before the fall. The second lens is the example of how Christ lived these areas. So you might say, look at the ideal of man before the fall, and look at the perfection of man as shown in Christ. The two, of course, complement each other and can help put into focus our own direction and destiny and setting of priorities. Let's start with work. Lens 1. Recall that in the garden, man was expected to work even before the fall. So daily labor is divinely planned. And in a state of perfection, we would still be working. Quite a thought. I think that can be helpful to contemplate when you get up to go to work each day, as it so often can just seem a burden, a daily grind, a distraction from deeper things. Now the other lens, the life of Christ. Well, Almighty God, creator of all that is, chose to use one human life to reveal himself to us and to show us the perfect man. And what did that man do? After about 15 years of growing up, he apparently worked as a normal carpenter for the next 15 years or so. It was only the last 3 years of his life that he began his public ministry. And what does this tell us? It tells us a very, very, very great deal. About 47% of his life was committed to professional work, without any miracles or public preaching that we know of. And we can be absolutely sure that Christ continued his dialogue with God right through all that day-to-day grind. He prayed with and through his daily work. This leads to idea number 8. Let us never think that work is not part of God's original plan, or that work is a distraction from our spiritual life. God clearly did not think so. So we cannot. We can and should bring God into our work and bring our work to God. Now, family. The first lens, what was our original destiny before the fall? To live in a community of persons, man, woman, then children, we assume, with God as a family. In fact, take one step further back to the Trinitarian nature of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. It too denotes a community of persons, a kind of divine family. So the concept of the family not only transcends national or social origins, it predates the fall, it predates creation itself. Now that for lofty stature. Our families are intended to reflect, though admittedly quite poorly in our fallen state, that loving communion of persons. Nourishing the family should be among our highest priorities in life. Now, I realize I'm in the stratosphere of abstraction here. So let's hazard going from the sublime to the ridiculous and propose one concrete resolution you could make. Don't worry too much about the expense and take your family on a fabulous vacation. Now, lens number two, the example of Jesus as regards the family. As mentioned earlier, Jesus spent 15 years growing up in his family, apparently without much notice in the community. Again, 47% of his life, first being a helpless baby in diapers, then a toddler, then a young child, then an adolescent. Now, what does this tell us? A very great deal. If God made family life such a priority during his one life on earth, we should too. Lastly, what about faith? I know you might think I've left you off the hook on this one. I mean, didn't he just say 47% work and 47% family? So that leaves just a, I don't know, real small little percentage for faith. And heck, I do that. I'm in pretty good shape. I don't think I need to change anything. Well, whoa, hold on there. Stay with me a little longer. I think when it comes to spiritual, even religious activities, you and I are probably similar, that we put these things on the proposed wish list, the future to-do list, at the end of all our more pressing activities. It's one more demand on our time. And usually, as mentioned earlier, we let the urgent overwhelm the important and never realize those good intentions. We see life pretty much as one giant juggling act, right? Now, I wish I really could juggle and we could have more time and then we could act this out. It'd be great fun. You know, you could write down various responsibilities on different balls and toss them up at me and I'd start juggling. You'd toss up, hold down a full-time job and be home for dinner and earn enough to support the family needs, you know, real key ones. And then you'd add in, church on Sunday and then get the daughter to her skating lessons, and then, this weekend I have to go fishing with my buddy, and I got to fix the kitchen sink, and right? On and on. Oh, and the most important, I've got to watch the Pats and the Bruins and the Celtics and the Red Sox. Hey, guy, you got to do something about your spiritual life. Yeah, I do. Oh, he's probably right. I got to do that. So what? Join the Knights of Columbus and go to show up at Nocturnal Adoration, and I'll join the Paris Council. Right? If I was acting this out very, very soon, of course, I'd start dropping balls all over the place. If you stack on more church activities, it's inevitably going to force out other things at work or in the family. Life is, after all, a zero-sum game. Allow me to suggest we have this all wrong. Authentic human life, as it's meant to be lived, is not a zero-sum game. This leads to idea number nine. What God wants from you and from me is not a few more balls of church activity juggled in the air, nor is he primarily interested in us following the rules of his church. He wants relationship, communion. He wants our love. Now, love is the furthest thing from a zero-sum game as you can get. After all, the more you give it away, the more it grows. And the more love grows in your life, the more room there is for it. From this perspective, then, adding more activities, even laudable church activities, might in fact do very little to deepen our interior life, our relationship with our Creator. In a word, prayer must come before volunteerism. In that sense, I have left you off the hook. But now let's consider this concept of prayer from the perspective, the lens number one. Before the fall, man was destined to live in constant, uninterrupted communion with his Creator. Now, this single idea has had a huge impact in my own thinking about faith, family, and work, and I hope I've allowed it to have consequences. To explain, I have to back up a bit. Actually, quite a bit. Now, how old is the universe as far as we know? I believe it's 13.7 billion years. And life was started on this planet just under 4 billion years ago, culminating in the astonishing creature called man. Now, each of us is a collection of 37 trillion cells. And each cell is complex beyond belief, all of them working in precise coordination and balance and interdependence. In order to do what? Because after all, the miracle of life, and life is such a miracle, you know, you're taking inanimate dead molecules of carbon, hydrogen, and oxygen, those are the main three, and somehow mixing them together so you end up with an independent, sentient, self-replicating creature. But anyway, this miracle of life is also shared with millions of other creatures. You know, they can move. They have delight of the senses, all five senses. They mate. They live in community. They have at least primitive forms of language and of consciousness. So again, what are humans here in order to do? Well, the crowning glory of the universe as we know it is the creation of a physical being who could pray, who could live in dialogue with God. That was our original destiny. That was why creation was pulsing across all those billions of years. Your and my ability to pray is apparently worth 13.7 billion years of divine preparation. So I hope this is an idea which has real consequences for you, as it has for me. Prayer is not an extra in life. It's not just for priests or pastors, or for the idle or for the desperate. Prayer is the raison d'être for our very existence. It's not something we just do in church. It's meant to permeate every activity, naturally, like an ongoing conversation with your closest friend. Now, of course, we are on the other side of the fall, and these lovely abstractions sure don't seem to fit reality. There sure ain't no uninterrupted communion with, as Peyton Manning would put it, the man upstairs. Prayer is often unnatural. It's hard. It's often empty. But at least, if we understand its importance as a core value, its place in the created order, we can work towards making it a higher priority. And yes, we still have to juggle various demands on our time. That never stops. But we don't have to feel pulled in opposite directions between work or family life over here in the secular world and church and faith life over there in the spiritual world. And that's idea number 10. We're called to live a unified life in which we know our main reason for being is to love and communicate with God as our Father during all our activities, whether work or faith or family. It's the interior life that unifies our existence, not outer activities. So now consider briefly the lens of Christ's life. Almost all his years spent, at least outwardly, on family and professional work. But is there any doubt, as I mentioned earlier, that he was in constant dialogue with God, the Father and God, the Holy Spirit, whether enjoying family life or hard at work? Of course not. That is the template for each human person, for you and for me. Now, let's be honest. We can sometimes see our faith as vague, remote, maybe just a static set of beliefs. You know, sure, I'm a Christian. I go to church on Sunday and I believe most of what the church teaches. Well, here's a challenging parallel. Now, it's not theologically accurate. There is the grace of baptism, for example, but I think it's quite valid in making an important point. Suppose I claim I'm an active football player, and you quite naturally ask, well, where do you practice, or what drills do you do, or what team do you play on? And I answer, actually, I don't do any of those things. I just believe in the rules of the game. And in fact, all of them, I very proudly announce. And on Sunday, every Sunday, I watch a game for an hour. Ha! And sometimes I volunteer on the field to prepare the equipment, and I'm on the committee to help map out the schedule. I am some football player, aren't I? Well, Am I a football player? No, I'm not a player at all. I'm a mere spectator, truthfully, and maybe a very good one, but not even part of the game. Now, allow me to suggest that the real game of the Christian life is recovering this interior dialogue with God. That does not mean adding any new activities to our lives, but it does mean at least some time set aside each day to relearn how to talk to God. In a word, to pray. Try it. Set aside 20, 30 minutes a day and see if it doesn't change your life from the inside out. So idea number 11 and my last one. Make personal daily prayer among the highest priorities in your life. It's the primary reason you exist. Though, sorry, I guess I didn't leave you off the hook on this one, huh? Now, of course, there's no time to talk about how to pray, but let me just say it should be natural. Give thanks, complain, explain, ask for help, but never ever put on a mask or try to be something you're not. Don't be eloquent, don't be pious, be natural. So, in conclusion, I realize my story, especially my career path, is a bit unusual. And I know those construction trucks that you see on the highway are sort of fitting. I think of that orange sign at the back, doesn't it say, do not follow this vehicle? So maybe I should have something like that on my back that says, don't follow this professional path. So the particulars of my career may not be transferable. But my hope is that at least some of the ideas I've enumerated can be relevant to your situation, that maybe one or two ideas will take root and have real consequences in your life. Each of us has to decide on our core values, on our true priorities, and then see if our day-to-day lives line up with those values. So by all means, forget all the particulars I've shared, but sit down, make your own list, and begin the lifelong adventure of trying to put them into practice amid the clutter and chaos of daily life. Best luck on the journey, and thank you.